Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Amazing news week and an amazing news day here. John McCain yesterday outed, I guess, for the day before yesterday, his conversation with Katie Couric. Was Katie Couric just like, you know, unaware of CBS? I mean, why did they edit this thing out? He says that the surge paid, you know, in other words, military force caused the sheikhs in Anbar province to fall to their knees and be nice to us. When in fact what happened was before the elections of 2006, before there was any discussion of an escalation or even the word surge had been floated, in the September of 2006, the sheikhs of Anbar Anbar province came to us and said, we'll stop shooting at you guys if you'll start giving us some money. And we said, fine, you know, we'll pay your people and stop shooting at us. And they did. And we did. And this is called the awakening, right? And that cut violence dramatically. And then we had the surge. Is this a mistake or is it a lie? And then, of course, we've got today's Wall Street Journal. The richest see income share rise, top 1%, highest rate since 1929 as a percentage of overall income. Lowest tax rate. Their taxes have dropped significantly. The average tax rate in 2006 for the top 1% was 22.8%. Back in 96, it was 28.9%. So the rich are doing much, much better. The poor are doing not quite so well. But, you know, we all remember Barbara Bush's very thoughtful comments on this, of course.
And so many of the people in the arenas here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. This is working very well for them.
Yes, it's working very well for them. Well, it's working very well for her. Anyhow, that said, there are also other things going on. Down in the Miami airport, they are strip-searching people by electronic means, and there's a piece of legislation moving through Congress that wants your information, your fingerprints specifically. John Berlau is with us. He's the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, the conservative think tank. John, welcome to the show.
Good to be on, Tom, as always.
Thank you. John, this is, if I'm reading your op-ed correctly, this is something that you and I are agreeing on, which I think is something that we should highlight, that, you know, why is the government taking fingerprints from people who work in the mortgage industry and people who are getting mortgages, handing them off to the FBI? And then even more bizarre, why is the FBI allowed to sell that information to private corporations?
Well, this is what would happen if this provision in the bill relating to, you know, government-sponsored enterprises, mortgages, passes. This was inserted. This was put in the Senate version of the bill, and unfortunately, I just found out last night it was in the House version, as been opposed by you and I, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the American Conservative Union.
Yeah, this is something that I think Americans can reach across any kind of ideological divides and say this is just a simple violation of the Fourth Amendment. In the United States, we have this fundamental principle that you are innocent until proven guilty, and that you are only to be your the Fourth Amendment. The privacy of your personal effects and your person can only be invaded if somebody swears under oath that there is probable cause that you have committed a crime, and therefore an investigation is initiated. And this is guilty until proven innocent, and prove that you're innocent rather than innocent until proven guilty.
Right, and it would not, that's so right, and it would not really even affect, like, say, the Angela Mozillos, some of the chief executives. I mean, a lot of clerical part-time workers, basic people who read, you know, negotiate loan terms over the phone. Loan originator is defined so broadly, you know, anyone who takes a residential loan application, offers or negotiate terms of a residential mortgage loan for compensation or gain, which, you know, could do just about anybody does some of those things. People who were not responsible at all for what's going on would be subject to this.
Now, who's behind this thing? I know, like with drug testing, you know, people thought the drug testing was all about, let's make driving safer. Actually, behind that was a multi-million-dollar industry that is now a multi-billion-dollar industry. A friend of mine actually started a company back in the 70s out of his bedroom. He was a chemist, selling in High Times magazine so people could test the quality of their pot, selling drug testing kits, you know, for $15 through the mail. And he has become a multi-hundred millionaire. I mean, he sold his company for hundreds of millions of dollars back about 10 years ago because when they started doing mandatory drug testing, there was all this demand for drug test kits. He had them. He was selling them. And it was like 8 cents worth of chemicals that he could sell for $45. And so this drug testing industry has really, really pushed the idea. Is there a fingerprinting industry out there that's going to make some money? I mean, who's pushing this thing?
I'm sure there are always. I don't know exactly. I know we do know that the main co-sponsors of the bill that had this were Mel Martinez, Republican of Florida, and Dianne Feinstein, who's a Democrat.
California.
It was not really a liberal Democrat one of the more conservative or moderate from California. They've actually been the only ones that I've seen that actually defend this thing, and I think it's more of a function of people not reading the bill, and this is something that sounds good, like sort of like three strikes you're out, without really analyzing. I mean, I don't think I don't know how this would have prevented some of the things that went on in the mortgage market. Really,
it wouldn't have prevented any of it. I mean, what went on in the mortgage market was a failure of regulation. It was the stupidity of Lyndon Johnson back in 1968 in privatizing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to get them off the budget so that he could hide the cost of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's insane to just say that this would, and there are, there's little, identity protection as far as the database from requirements for measures for protection of identity theft or how this is going to be misused. I mean, it's just not a lot of thought, I don't think, went into this provision.
So we're talking with John Berlau, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, which is joining the ACLU in protesting this crazy piece of legislation, Senate and House bill, the bailout that will create what's called the nationwide mortgage licensing system and registry, gathering information concerning the applicant's identity, including fingerprints. And I mean, this is just totally, totally bizarre. John, what in the conservative world? How, you said the conservative union is opposed to this. I'm guessing, though, that there are many of the kind of Dick Cheney conservatives, the let's get all the information we can on Americans, the let's wiretap their phones conservatives, who are saying, hey, cool idea.
There is a lot of, Mel Martinez and Dianne Feinstein both defended this, and, there is still
they both voted for the Patriot Act, too.
Yes, and there's still a lot of, if you didn't commit a crime, if you have nothing to hide, why should you worry? And you should worry if you love the Constitution.
Yeah. This reminds me, in Miami, the and this is just one of many airports that are doing this, but it's getting a lot of the publicity. They're now using these machines that basically strip search you. And they're saying that the machines, which cost $170,000 a piece, by the way, and have detected no explosives so far, that the detail is so great. It's a virtual strip search, says Barry Steinhardt of the ACLU. He says if Playboy published these pictures, there'd be members of Congress calling them pornography. And I'm predicting that the only thing that would cause this to stop is if the National Enquirer ran a big story saying, John Boehner's equipment is smaller than Ted Kennedy's. You know, I mean, that kind of thing. It's like, as a result of these virtual strip searches. I mean, how bizarre is this going to get? How far the invasion of our privacy, the assumption that we're guilty before we're proven innocent. This is nasty stuff.
It is, and you know, the unpopular industries, like, you know, the mortgage industry, others are, you know, the ones, you know, and, or the employees in that are the ones, you know, they go after, it seems easy, but that's, you know, this slippery slope, and that's, you know, why yeah. I think the ACLU.
It reminds me of Milton Mayer's book where, you know, they thought they were free, which people can buy over at BuzzFlash.com or many other sites, but I wrote a great review of it, or a review that has a lot of great excerpts from it over at BuzzFlash.com. In which he went back to Germany and he interviewed people who, just average people, who had, you know, who had been joined the Nazi party simply because they had to for their jobs and things, who didn't say anything as the trains went by, if you know what I mean. One of them was a university professor, and he said, you have to understand, this was so slow. Every step seemed small and logical. If all of them had been done at once, people would have been in the streets. But every small step is how they did it, you know, and it seems like that's what's happening here.
Well, hopefully it won't, but openmarket.org is where we have an entry about this.
Okay, openmarket.org. Great. John Berlau, the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Center for Entrepreneurship. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
Going on out there in Washington, D.C., I'll tell you, back in 2001, Bob Novak, the right-wing commentator and author and everything else, 77 years old, in 2001, according to an article in the Washington Post's Reliable Sources column, he yelled at a guy who was jaywalking, "Learn to read the signs, bodily orifice." Novak snapped before speeding away. Novak explained to the paper he was crossing on the red light. He's talking about pedestrian. "I really hate jaywalkers. I despise them. Since I don't run the country, all I can do is yell at them. The other option is to run them over. But as a compassionate conservative, I'd never do that." Well, looks like that's what he did. Bob Novak in police custody after he hit a pedestrian with his black Corvette in downtown Washington, D.C. this morning. He says, "I didn't know I hit him." Yeah. Novak has earned a reputation around the Capitol, this is from the Politico article, as an aggressive driver easily identified in his convertible sports car. So, anyhow, let me get back to this topic. I just want to get back to this topic and maybe even take it a little bit far afield and bring it back around again. First of all, this whole thing of, you know, government by fear, laptops being taken now by customers as you come into the United States. They will take your laptop and download the contents of your hard drive, or in some cases simply take the laptop from you, and in some cases it takes months for you to get it back while they're examining your hard drive to see what. Who knows? They haven't found any terrorist stuff that we know of so far, although they have busted a bunch of people for pornography. And then you've got the terrorist watch list. Over 400,000 people. You know, the news a couple days ago was there's a million people on the terrorist watch list. The Department of Homeland Security says, "Oh no, it's not a million, it's 400,000." 400,000? Well, according to the International Institute for Strategic Studies, this is the major British think tank on terrorism and things. Al Qaeda has over 60 nations, a total membership of 18,000 people. So 18,000 people in Al-Qaeda. It was estimated at its peak just after 9/11. It was 25,000. Now it's 18,000. And we have 400,000 Americans on a watch list. Not necessarily all of them Americans, but many of them a no-fly list. This is crazy. So let me just bring this around to something. Oregon State University researchers recently discovered that if men take zinc, they're less likely to get prostate cancer. Now, what does this have to do with Homeland Security? I'm going to pull these together for you. Prostate cancer kills as many men as breast cancer kills women. Yet its research is only one quarter, 25% of the budget, at least in the UK, for prostate cancer as it is for men as breast cancer for women. Why? One theory is that women naturally create social networks, and there's like this sisterhood around, let's fight breast cancer. And men, you know, they tend to be more solitary, and they don't do that kind of thing. So much they talking about prostates, you know, it's not as fast, and it doesn't make good pictures on TV. Here's a woman getting a mammogram. Oh yeah, hey, let's look at that. Here's a guy getting a prostate exam. I don't think I want to see that. Okay, so bottom line is it's just not as popular. In fact, it's even a little more difficult to talk about, which leads us to this whole issue of this. You know, for example, fingerprinting people who are getting mortgages. It's just not popular. You know, it's like, okay, we're going to try and stop bad guys who are screwing up our economy. Well, that sounds good. Or registered a sex offender. I mean, there's a bunch of things that are just, like, not popular to talk about. Registered sex offenders. I mean, if somebody's a registered sex offender, life is really, really, really tough for them. And appropriately so, if they're a rapist or a child molester or something, appropriately so. But what about somebody who was busted, as we were talking about on the show a couple days ago, who's busted for peeing in his backyard? Or a 17-year-old boy who has sex with a 16-year-old girl, as happened down in Georgia, and he ended up as a registered sex offender. I mean, nobody wants to defend sex offenders, so there's no publicity, there's no discussion, and there's no change in crazy laws. Same with drug dealers. Who's going to defend drug dealers? But you've got all that. We've got hundreds of thousands of people in prison for selling what? A joint, you know, $5. It's crazy. And so this brings us to terror suspects. Who wants to defend terror suspects? Well, nobody. So we have our strip searches in the Miami airport. People languish in prison. Stupid laws stay in the books. People are dying from a lack of research, and we're losing our rights of privacy. Because of these peculiarities of our culture, of what we like to talk about and what we don't. We need to break through this stuff and have some open conversations about this. People don't like, you know, the last, everybody says, oh, don't compare the Bush administration to the Nazis. Well, you know, we could just as easily compare it to Mussolini. It's just that the Nazis are far more well-documented, or Pinochet's Chile, or, you know, half a dozen other repressive regimes around the world. But it is this steady erosion of rights. And it's not just the Bush regime. I mean, you've got Democrats participating in this as well. Dianne Feinstein co-authoring this legislation to fingerprint everybody and pass the information along to the FBI. What is wrong with this picture? And how can we fix it? Your thoughts on this, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. I think we need to talk about this stuff. I think we need to be calling it out. I think we need to go back to saying privacy is privacy, and it's an absolute right.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
There's a dark and the troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side.
Yeah, a little optimism is a good thing. Even in the face of pretty overwhelming weirdness out there. As I share, I just want to share with you real quickly, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here. Milton Mayer, back in the 1950s, after World War II, he was a reporter in Chicago, and he went to Germany, and he met with 10 good Germans, in quotes, and interviewed them about, you know, why didn't you say anything? Why, you know, for example, this is one of his, he got to know these people and actually liked them quite, you know, got to, he says they're decent people. These were German Christians who watched the Jews going, you know, anyhow, here's the, he quotes this one guy, he says, this guy was a university professor. He says, what happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information that the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, and there were real reforms, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us have ever had the occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood that what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing, and one day it is over his head. And it goes on. I mean, you can read the review over at BuzzFlash. It's just, we are seeing it all over again. Anthony in Seattle, at least that dimension of it.
On that same note, Tom, there in Portland, you can't even get into the federal building without having, you have to have business there. You have to have, like, someone expecting you,
right,
and or be escorted by another federal employee. That's an
And it's that way in most of the major office buildings now in New York City.
And it's like, you know, what if you don't know what you're there for? But, you know, anyway, what I was calling about is here in Washington State, we have the largest marine highway system. It's the Washington State Ferry System,
mm-hmm,
and it goes from, you know, Seattle and the mainland over to the peninsula. Mm-hmm. So the Washington State Ferries have just absolutely they are getting inundated with all this Homeland Security money, and they're funding, you know, state patrol troopers and drug sniffing. Well, actually, they say they're not drug sniffing. They're bomb sniffing dogs,
mm-hmm,
special trained bomb sniffing dogs to go up and down the aisles of waiting cars with their passengers to sniff your car, and they get to peer inside your car. So now the new thing is they've just bought these $100,000 cameras that take pictures of your license plate and then immediately send that to both state and FBI databases to match it against if you're a child support deadbeat, if you have wants and warrants, if you're wanted on an FBI, you know, for whatever. And so while you're on the ferry, they can have the police waiting for you at your destination. So, but the thing is that, you know, it's only for the ferry system, and it's like, you know, what about the other transportation?
Well, it's just like the airports. I mean, you can still get on a train or a subway so far without being searched, but it's like it starts someplace. This is the thing. And Anthony, excellent point. It starts someplace, and then they just push it and push it and push it, and then it goes even farther. As you know, again from Milton Mayer's book, he says uncertainty. This is one of these good Germans. He says uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside in the streets, in the general community, everyone's happy. No one hears protest, certainly sees none against these security measures. You know, in France or Italy, there'll be slogans against the government on the walls. But in Germany, it's not even this. In the university community, your own colleagues, your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom feel as you do. And what do they say? They say, oh, it's not so bad. You're seeing things. You're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying this must lead to that, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the other hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, they intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as being pessimistic or even neurotic. But the one great shocking occasion where tens or hundreds of thousands will join you never comes. That's the difficulty. if the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and the smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked. If we, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers in the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C isn't so much worse than B, and if you did not make a stand at B, then why should you take a step at C and so on to D? And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case it was my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew, swine, collapses all at once, and you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring, the houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays, but the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, the spirit has changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one seems transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. Amazing. Chuck in San Jose, California. Hey, Chuck.
Hi. Yeah, Tom, you know, you're talking about fingerprinting.
Yeah.
The private corporation turned over to FBI.
Yeah.
Well, I drive an 18-wheeler, and several times I've gone to this one place, won't name where or who, but the security guard, the policy where you pick up, it's a load of toilet paper, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
What they require you to do is you first show your driver's license so that you're a commercial driver, and then when
right.
before you get the paperwork to sign off and leave, you are required to leave your thumbprint on their little, like a 3x5 card that the security
right.
guard collects.
Right, and pretty soon it'll be, let us swab your mouth for your DNA.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
then they'll pass the DNA off to the database, and it'll get sold to your health insurance company, which will say, oh, hey, we're looking at your DNA, and we see you're genetically predisposed to diabetes. We're not going to cover you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is just, it's so wrong. Chuck, thank you very much for the heads up on that. I mean, this is incredible. Beth in Minneapolis, listening on the web stream there. Hey, Beth.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to mention that the first third of Vince Bugliosi's new book is about this issue. He tries to shake you out of your lethargy and try to get you to see reality.
Right, the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder, his Vince Bugliosi's new book.
Right,
yeah.
And that's interesting because we do go along complacently. But, you know, there are a lot of us today that are aware of all these things, thanks to you, thanks to your program and others like it. And I guess what we need to do is protest every single little thing. That's the only
yeah.
way. Once there is enough of this, people will see.
But they're going to cut this deal here, Beth, in Congress, where they're going to say, yeah, okay, you want to have a mortgage system that works. You want to keep this thing alive. You want to keep the economy from collapsing. We're going to have to take fingerprints. And it's
But, Tom, it's not right. And
I know. That's what I'm saying.
But they stick something in every bill that is unconstitutional.
I know. And, Beth, thank you very much for the call and for pointing it out. I agree with you. People don't know how to respond. It's like if you're going through the Miami airport and they say, would you please step into this machine and put your arms out? And you know that you're going to be completely naked. Well, I don't frankly care all that much. I think most men don't. I can't speak for all men, but for myself, I mean, you know, it's not a big deal. I think it's probably more a big deal for women, oddly enough. I think they're probably a little more concerned about a guy standing there, you know, looking at a screen and seeing them naked. But the point is that I would still say, you know, no thanks. I'm not guilty of anything. Therefore, you don't have the right to search me. And at that point, okay, well, then you're going to get patted down. Well, that's still halfway there. I mean, it's just so wrong. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff. We got a minute before the break here, Jeff. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What's up?
Well, the number of things we need to do. First of all, we need to stop accepting little things like these new Visa cards that have the radio chip inside them, the RFID.
Right.
We've also got to stop electing false Democrats, such as Dianne Feinstein, Ken Salazar here in Colorado.
Yep.
And we really need to pay attention to who's going to be the candidate, not just who we vote for in November.
Right. That's why Bernie Sanders keeps saying, vote for progressive Democrats, not just Democrats.
We should be thinking right now about who's running in 2010 for Congress and for Senate, and we should be considering running ourselves. And another thing we need to do is we need to enforce the damn laws right now. We need to have Bush hearings on everything Bush has done. We just went into an illegal war. Where is the outrage?
No, I agree. As it was a point that Jonathan Turley made last night on Keith Olbermann's show. Jeff, thank you so much for the call. It's always great to hear from you. Yeah, absolutely. We have war criminals running our government, and we're doing nothing? The Democrats are doing nothing? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Poor Laszlo Mozer. This guy, Bonita Springs, Florida, I'm assuming, busted. Stole 42 cents from a mall fountain. 42 cents! Police record, yeah. $500 bail. Amazing. Alan in Boca Raton, Florida, you want to share with me the old bromide that Hitler and Mussolini used, in fact, that, you know, hey, if you want to live in a free society, you've got to give up some of your freedoms to have this place work well, right?
Gee, you take all the wind out of my sails. When you talk to me, you're preaching to the choir, because I do agree with you. But I just wondered, if we'd have been scrutinized like this in World War II, would we have won the war?
What do you mean?
Didn't we give up personal freedoms in World War II? Weren't our letters read? Weren't things done that if they were done today, we would say this is the beginning?
Yeah, to some extent there were, although it was pretty much under the radar. We didn't find out about most of it until after the fact. The Japanese internment, of course, was a real horror. But the interesting thing is that it didn't produce any positive results. It didn't help us win the war. And, you know, we won the war because Eisenhower was a brilliant military strategist. I mean, you know, it's among other things. And because Nazism was collapsing and because Hitler made some stupid moves going into Russia at least a year early and he ran out of oil. I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why the war went the way it did in the time scale that it did. And I think very, very little of it had to do with that. So, no, I don't, you know, over and over and over again, what you see, Alan, is societies who give up their liberties, societies who give up their freedoms, end up as, you know, Ben Franklin, you know, anybody who's willing to give up a little bit of liberty for security will end up with neither. And they end up with neither. That's where it goes. I'm sorry. That's just where it goes. And that's where this is going. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Thanks for the call. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Well, I was wondering, what do you think of the unitary principle? And do you think that it has anything at all to do with, does Fuhrer principle, the principle of the father?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The unitary executive principle that's been put forward by the Bush administration and that frankly was, you know, put forward by the Nixon administration. And I mean, that's what you can track it back to in large part. Although John Adams, I suppose, you know, claimed the same thing. It really is the principle of kingdom. And so to the extent that it's been used by tyrants all over the world, they're asserting that they are kings. And, you know, that's the bottom line. Obsidian in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, and we don't have a kingdom here. We have a democracy. Hi, Obsidian.
I think you hit a wonderful topic at this point in time. Reason being is that the general public tends to take things as being just the usual cost of living, as it were, and what you have to tolerate. Mm-hmm. However, it reminds me of a conversation I had with my husband, and whenever I spot something, I said, yeah, they're doing that, and next thing they'll be doing this, and so forth and so on. And of course, he'll say, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory. But my train of thought in return is, what exactly is conspiracy and what isn't?
Right, and this is a conspiracy that's being done right out in the open, just like
exactly.
The German one was, just like the Italian one fascists were, just like the Spanish fascists were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in every single case, they're saying they're doing it right out and open, and they're saying, we're doing this because we need to keep you safe.
Exactly.
And I'm sorry, that's not, in my mind, the primary purpose of government. The primary purpose of government is to create a society in which we can collectively work together with freedom and safety. Yeah, it's an important thing, but it is not the important thing. There are higher values.
Yeah,
and,
but you know something, Tom? I apologize. Wait till it turns around where the government starts trying to use that material or information against the public.
Yeah, well, they already are. I mean, you got 400,000 people who can't get on an airplane right now. And in fact, you know, as congressional hearings pointed out the other day, one of them was a reporter who was reporting on the terrorist watch list. And all of a sudden he ends up on the terrorist watch list because he wrote one of the expose pieces 2 years ago for the New York Times. I mean, this is, exactly. Obsidian, thank you for the call. Excellent point. This is, just incredible. Carlos in West Orange, New Jersey. Hey, Carlos. You're
Hello?
On the air. Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I was arguing with my daughter right now.
So, what's up?
What I called about is impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very funny thing.
Friday will be the hearings, Dennis Kucinich's hearings.
That's nonsense.
Yeah, I agree. It's not going to happen, Carlos.
It's all nonsense. Let me tell you something.
But it's not nonsense. The hearings are not nonsense, and what Kucinich is going to say is not nonsense. But
it's all nonsense. I was watching C-SPAN the other day, and I was listening to NAGLA, the Justice Department, under Kanye's.
Yeah.
He was saying that
Gerald
impeachment
Nathan
doesn't
either.
Work. It's not going to work right now.
Right. Right.
There's only been one impeachment in history of 200 and...
There's been two, actually, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton.
Right, okay, that's fine. No problem. What I was talking about, what my point was, is in regards to impeachment, we have, 435 members of the House?
Yeah.
All right. Up for re-election every year.
Every two years. Yeah.
Okay. And we have probably 23 senators.
What's your point, Carlos?
My point is very simple. We need to get rid of all of them.
Yeah. You know, there are days when I wouldn't disagree with you. But, no, there's some good members of Congress. There definitely are. But your point is taken. Grover in Sunnyvale, California. Got a minute before we got to wrap this hour up.
Sure. Good morning.
Yeah.
Listen, I feel, and I know a lot of people that feel, you made a statement that it comes in little increments and people don't get it until the end. I know of at least three dozen people personally that we feel we get up every day for the last 7 years. We feel like we're living in a parallel universe here.
Yeah.
This is absurd. We've got a constitution that we've paid attention to and followed those laws for over 232 years, and all of a sudden they come along and try to make new laws. The people you talk all the time about getting people got to get involved. And actually, it's got to be down at the grassroots. And the last caller that was just on, he made a very poignant statement, and it's true. We got to throw all those bums out.
I think we need to throw out the bums who won't get along with the program. I would not want to throw out Robert Wexler. I would not want to throw out Peter DeFazio. I wouldn't want to throw out Bernie Sanders. But there's.
No, you're right, Tom, about that.
Thank you, Grover. I appreciate the call. At a certain point, I mean, you know, there has to be some discernment here. Let us not become reactionaries, but we have to be looking at this situation with clear eyes and understanding what's really going on. Terry Jeffrey with CNS News is up next. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Is Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the intrusive side of big government. And I thought it was interesting, you know, John Berlow of the Competitive Enterprise Institute agreeing with me that good conservatives would say no thanks to strip search x-ray machines in the Miami airport or to being fingerprinted when you get a mortgage. But what about collective insurance programs, for example, like Social Security? Terry Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com. And, Terry, just following up on this conversation, first of all, I'm wondering if you will join us, John Berlow and I, in condemning this bailout legislation that is that has been introduced into the House and Senate, both containing provisions that require anybody who gets a mortgage or anybody who originates a mortgage to submit their fingerprints to the FBI, and they may even end up in private corporate hands.
Yeah, that's absurd. That's completely ridiculous.
Yeah. This Mel Martinez and Dianne Feinstein in the Senate proposing this, this is just nuts.
And we can all get a retina scan, and they'll take a DNA sample, too.
Right. That's why I said the next thing they're going to ask for is a swab in your mouth, you know, to get the DNA. And then the health insurance companies will be saying, oh, hey, look at this. You've got a genetic predisposition to diabetes. We don't think we're going to cover you.
Yeah.
And on it goes. I mean, this is just so wrong. You've got an op-ed here, Guaranteed Government, and you're talking about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac broadly, but it also gets into this issue of dependency on Uncle Sam. You want to give your riff on this?
Yeah, the big point I make in my piece, Tom, is that if you look at American history, sort of step back and take the broad view, from the time of the founding up till about the 1930s, Americans pretty much took care of themselves, and the idea of government was protect us from foreign enemies and protect our liberties, the things that are in the Bill of Rights.
Actually, may I interrupt you and just
sure.
challenge a little bit of that?
Sure.
From the founding of this country up until the 1830s, the major role of government was to take land from Native Americans and give it to settlers. The government was big daddy. Government was the, you know, anybody who wanted 100 acres, 160 acres, 120 acres, depending on the state, depending on the territory, 40 acres, 80 acres, whatever, of Indian country could have it. And there was a massive amount of land and a lot of mining rights and stakes, and the railroads got hundreds of, in today's dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe trillions of dollars worth of free land. The government was big daddy. By the 1830s, and I'd say, you know, the Andrew Jackson administration, more or less, by that point, the country was, you know, most of the Indian land that could be easily taken was gone. And at that point, the government started to step back, and from the 1830s, until the 1920s, by and large, government's role was far more passive.
Well, look, I will say this. You know, I'm not going to argue that the government of the United States was fair to American Indian tribes in the 19th century.
No, but what I'm saying is that the founding generation, the founders' generation, they saw government as a benevolent force.
Well, to tell you,
much like Franklin Roosevelt did.
I would tell you, you know, if you sort of looked at it from a natural law argument, and actually the way some of the founders did, if you're looking at a vast expanse of unsettled land, which much of North America was. And I'm not going to say that some of this land didn't rightfully belong to Indians. Of course it did, but there's also vast unused land.
It was not unused.
It was
used differently than the way we use it.
Well, we can argue that, but grant me just for the sake of completing my logic here that
sure.
If you find in North America a vast, some unused land that cannot be argued belongs to an Indian tribe, and someone goes out there and uses his labor to develop that land, I would argue it becomes his property.
Well, that was the argument that was made, but the Native Americans were saying, wait a minute, we use this land. These are our hunting grounds. We've been protecting
sure.
and preserving these for, you know, 30,000 years. This is not something you can take.
You know,
but I don't think we should be
right.
debating, you know, the theft of America, of Native American lands here. It's a topic that, you know, it's taking us off this. You're saying basically in your op-ed piece here that by government creating Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which reinvigorated the mortgage markets, that this is just another piece of the New Deal that was making Americans dependent upon government.
Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, Fannie Mae expressly was a piece of the New Deal. It was created in the 1930s
yep.
to buy up mortgages from banks so banks could make new mortgages. And by giving sub-market interest rates to Fannie Mae that a commercial bank couldn't, it was providing an indirect subsidy. It was subsidizing the bankers by subsidizing the bankers.
Right, because we viewed as a social good people being able to buy houses.
Right, subsidizing homeowners.
We also subsidized it with a tax break for mortgage interest.
But now the point, though, is that that, like everything else, there's no free lunch. Someone's got to pay for it. And now we're in a situation that I believe prefigures what we're going to see in Social Security and Medicare, where the bills are starting to come due for this anti-market subsidy of housing. Now, I think people would have got the housing in the free market because capitalists would have had an incentive to go out there and build the houses and sell them at a price that people could buy and make sure they got financing in the free market. When you got the government in there, you created perverse incentives, and now we're in the situation where everybody's going to have to pay a bailout that I think will be more expensive than it would have been had we never...
Actually, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were working just fine until 1968 when Lyndon Johnson got a hold of them, and he wanted to hide the money from the Vietnam War. He was trying to bury the cost of the Vietnam War, so he sold off large chunks of them to private owners. He basically privatized most of them, mm-hmm. and to raise money and to hide them on the budget. And now we have this bizarre public-private entity, and that's something that I oppose. I think that they should have stayed as government agencies, entities.
You know, but Tom, if you did that, then the government would own all our mortgages. And I don't think we want, I mean, that flat out is socialism, where you have the government owning the mortgages. I don't think either.
The government was guaranteeing the mortgages.
Well, when the government purchases the mortgages from the bank, it owns them.
Oh, okay, arguably.
And that's what Fannie Mae does. I mean, it takes some of these things and wraps them up in these complex securities and resells them.
Right.
Others, it just owns flat out.
Right. But most of them, they're not. Actually, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were not owning them before 68, before they were privatized. They didn't hold on to these things. They just moved them back out into the marketplace.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
Well,
that's like the federal government issuing treasury notes and moving them out of the marketplace.
Because it gets the government involved in distorting and subsidizing the marketplace, it is not needed.
But sometimes you want to distort the marketplace to achieve a social good.
Yeah, and now we're getting a social bad where we all have to bail it out.
Right, because it was privatized.
Excuse me?
Because it was privatized. Semi-privatized.
Well, it's never really been private. It's had a special relationship with the government. You and me have been subsidizing the flow of money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac all along. And by subsidizing the flow of money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, we're subsidizing the flow of money to these big banks that are doing the mortgages.
No, but and I would say before 68, we actually weren't. We were, you know, there was a system set up that was not costing us a great deal of money at all, frankly, because all of those mortgages were being resold as securities, and it was just moving through, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were basically just bureaucracies with guys with green eye shades, you know, making $35,000 a year with a government pension working for them. After Lyndon Johnson privatized them, they became these huge corporations with CEOs making $100 million salary or huge salaries,
right.
and boards of directors and stockholders, and everybody was sucking money out of it, and that's when it got evil, when it was the synthesis of capitalism and government.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with you on that, but they're not really privatized when they have a special relationship.
Right, I agree with you. It was semi-privatized, and that was what was wrong.
If the government was, I would argue, Tom, if the government was never involved in the first place, people would have gone out there and built homes, banks would have gone out there and loaned money, everything would have gone along fine. We socialized the thing and distorted the market. And
it
now
got us out of the Great Depression, Terry.
Excuse me?
It
did not get us out of the Great Depression.
The New Deal got us out of the Great Depression.
No, it didn't.
It certainly did. I mean, it got slowed down a little by World War II because Roosevelt had to divert a lot of the money that he was using to building roads and infrastructure and hospitals and schools into bombs. But
it was World War II when the economy started growing again.
No, the economy was growing very well in 38, 39, 40, 41.
Mm-hmm. But then we didn't need Fannie Mae.
Well, Fannie Mae was created in 38.
Here's my ultimate argument. I know you disagree with my concept of this, Tom, but here we have a indirect subsidy to people to buy housing. And we all agree, yeah, getting housing and owning a house is a good thing. We also believe that having retirement income is a good thing and having health care in your retirement is a good thing. But we've completely socialized retirement income and health care for elderly people in this country through Social Security and Medicare. And those are $53 trillion in the red. When we talk about the benefits that are
they're only $53 trillion in the red if you project out Reaganomics, Terry.
If you use the Comptroller General of the United States estimate.
Yeah, David Walker. He's been on this program. Can you stick around?
Sure.
Because I want to drill into this topic of whether we should have health insurance provided to all of us, whether we should have old age poverty insurance and disability insurance, also known as Social Security, provided to all of us, or if that insurance should only be provided by private corporations. We're talking with Terry Jeffries, CNSNews.com. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at Teamster.org. And just a quick heads up, on August 2nd and 3rd, I'll be in Madison, Wisconsin with our affiliate station, The Mike 92.1. I'll speak Saturday at the Nonstop Radio Symposium in the Exhibition Hall at Alliant Energy Center. And you can get information at nonstopradio.com. And on August 16th, we'll be in Seattle, Talk 1090. At the Seattle Center Exhibition Hall. You can get information about that at Talk 1090's website. And I'll also be doing the Radio Row from the Democratic and Republican conventions. And we'll be doing our show and visiting our radio stations in both Denver and Minneapolis. So I'll have all the details on that as we go on through the week. We're talking with Terry Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. And Terry, I think that this is the real conversation, frankly, that America should be having rather than just beating each other over the head and throwing slogans at each other about what kind of nation are we going to be. In your op-ed, you talk about creating Medicare and Social Security, and you say, in the process, Americans became increasingly dependent on Uncle Sam. This is a good thing for federal elected officials. They could take wealth from one group, tomorrow's taxpayers, and give it to another group, today's voters. And let me just use your frame of dependency and say, you know, rather than trying to rebut it, use it and ask the question, if the, you know, with insurance, what you have is a large pool, so you distribute risk over a large number of people. So, and you know, if you do it well, you can skim a little money off the top and make a profit. And that's how E.F. Stone and others, you know, he kind of founded the modern insurance industry, became a multimillionaire in his day. If I am buying health insurance from United Healthcare, am I not dependent on them for my life?
Well, it's a free market decision if you decide to buy it.
Right. But let's say that I decide to buy it from them. And then I get sick, and they want to pay their CEO, William McGuire, his $1.78 billion paycheck.
Right.
And so they say to me, you know, we've discovered that in your genetic code here, it shows that you were predisposed to this. Or we discovered that back 30 years ago, you had this happen, and therefore this is a pre-existing whatever. You know, they figure out some way to weasel out of paying the bill, or they simply change the terms on me.
Right.
I am dependent upon them, and I have no right to rebut it.
Well,
if I show up at William McGuire's door, or if I stand out in front of his office with a picket sign, they can have me arrested and put in jail as a stalker. If it's the government that's doing it, and I go to my congressman's office, I go and stand in front of Peter DeFazio's office or Earl Blumenauer's office, they have to invite me in and talk with them. I can throw those bums out of office.
Well, the insurance company has a requirement to fulfill the deal it made with you, and you would have...
But that would be by big government you're talking
you
about.
Would have a responsibility.
Regulating them.
You would have a responsibility to cut the right kind of deal. And unfortunately, in the current environment...
So everybody's supposed to be a lawyer.
Everybody, certainly caveat emptor, people need to be aware of what they're buying, and they need to be responsible for what they purchase. There's no doubt about that.
I just think that's tragic, Terry, that you're suggesting that being dependent upon a government that is responsive to us and where we can throw the supervisors out of office every 2 years is somehow worse than being dependent on a multi-billion-dollar corporation that can just tell me to go screw myself anytime they want.
Your argument is not right there, Tom, because you're not dependent on the government. You're not dependent on the insurance company. You're dependent on your own free choice as a free individual for the way you decided to provide for your health care.
Terry, if I had diabetes, which I don't, but if I was diabetic and I didn't have health insurance and I was out there trying to buy it at my age, there's no company that would sell it to me. Mm-hmm. Or if they did, there was no way that I could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd have to find another way to get your health care.
Right. In other words, I go broke.
Is the right thing to do to have the federal government then take over the health care industry? I think
no. No, I'm saying it's the right thing to do is to have the federal government take over the health care insurance industry.
Yeah.
Insurance is distributing the risk over the largest pool. I don't want the government running the hospital.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, Tom, but I think insurance itself has problems. I don't think insurance has been good for health care in the United States of America.
But those things that are insured...
And I think it would just compound it to have the government control it.
No, it's already a problem. It's part of the commons.
I don't believe that. I do not believe that everybody has a right to all the possible health care they could get. At some point,
Why not?
Because
it's necessary to keep you alive.
For one thing, it's impossible to provide. I mean, just as your friend David Walker, who you've interviewed, he's the guy who says it's $53 trillion we owe for Social Security.
Yeah, but let's stay on this. I mean, if we have the right to be insured against people breaking into our houses by police, that seems to work.
That's a local community decision, and they decide how much police they want, and that's fine. Some communities don't have any police. In a rural area, you may only have a sheriff. But already with the Medicaid, most of that 53
But it's
trillion,
government providing it. You're dependent upon the government.
Most of that $53 trillion is Medicare. It's something like $40 trillion of that. Is Medicare. The government has made us promises in terms of how they'll take care of us with our health and our old age that the government cannot afford to pay.
No, I agree with you. I think that they should lift the cap, the $100,000 cap on Social Security.
They can't tax their way out of it. They're talking
sure they
about
can.
20% of GDP it will cost to pay for this Medicare.
But it's already 20% of GDP. It's just that I'm paying it out of my pocket.
This
now Bill McGuire can tell me to go screw myself.
This is over and above what we're already doing. It would destroy our country to pay for that.
I think not. Every other industrialized country in the world seems to be doing well. But anyhow, we'll leave it at that. Terry Jeffrey, CNSNews.com. You can read his piece over there. Thanks, Terry. Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
Past the hour yesterday in the New York Times, just to take this one step further, and then pick up your calls on the topic. David Brooks, the conservative op-ed columnist for the New York Times, wrote a piece about the culture of debt. And he was talking about Gretchen Morgenson, who was profiled on the front page of Sunday's New York Times. She's a woman who was, you know, basically wiped out because her debt caught up with her, and she talked about how when she got a divorce, she went on a shopping spree to make herself feel better. She had surgery, cosmetic surgery. She went home watching the home shopping channels, charging thousands of dollars more, ran up her credit cards, and then her subprime mortgage went up, and boom, and with a divorce and losing her job, and basically she got wiped out. And you've got people on one side saying, okay, the system killed her. That is the whole, you know, this corporate greed promotion. Hey, here, have a free loan, have another credit card, have a subprime mortgage, and she's a victim. She's not responsible. And then you've got people on the other side saying, hey, she made all these choices. She was the one who chose to get the debt. She's the one who chose to get the credit card. She's the one who chose to charge the things, et cetera. And I thought David Brooks made an interesting point. David Brooks, who I almost never agree with, and that is that there's really a third way of looking at this. He says this is part of a larger societal or social story. And he talks about how we were once a culture of thrift. We learned this out of the Great Depression. And now that, he says, that unspoken code has been silently eroded. He says some of the toxins were economic. And what he doesn't point out is rising home prices allowed home buyers to think that they could be like, you know, wealthy stock players in the market, you know, that their home could be something that would be an appreciating asset that they could use to retire on. And so people were buying more house than they needed because it was investment. They were perceiving it as an investment. They didn't realize that this was a bubble that was going. But in any case, he points out this and how our society, our culture became more and more accepting of this. And I agree with him. And it's what's particularly interesting. I remember back years ago, I think it was what I was writing in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I'm not sure if it made it into the book or not. But there was a study on squirrels. Squirrels build nests. Regular, you know, red squirrels, gray squirrels, the kind of squirrels that live in your neighborhood. They build nests that are typically a particular size. And they're quite territorial. And what the scientists did is they took one squirrel in one, you know, one squirrel nest in one tree, and they added a whole bunch of leaves to it, made it 20% bigger. And what happened was all of the squirrels within viewing range of this squirrel nest, you know, within a quarter mile or so, they made their own nests 20% bigger. It's like and you know, nobody's really sure why. I mean, was it house envy, or was it some kind of biological switch that got turned on that, hey, that squirrel knows that it's going to be a hard winter. We need to have a bigger nest, so I better get a bigger nest. Was it some, you know, but it's in our DNA. And back in the 50s and the 60s, when you watched television and you saw the Jackie Gleason show, or you saw, you know, Laura, you know, Mary Tyler Moore, show, or you saw the Dick Van Dyke show, you go back, or, you know, Andy of Mayberry, you go back, and these were people who lived in simple middle class dwellings. Ralph Cramden, you know, he had a fourth floor walk up with a cold water walk up. I mean, you know, they had to heat the water on the stove to get hot water. He drove a bus for a living. They showed average Americans. In the 80s, that changed with the culture of greed and Reagan coming in, and greed is good, and let's celebrate everything corporate, and let's celebrate richness, and let's have, you know, Jimmy Carter walked to the presidential inaugural. Ronald Reagan went in a limousine. You know, it charged huge amounts of money, and everything. It was who had the fanciest, most expensive dress. Everything changed in the 80s. And in the 80s, on television, suddenly the average houses that you were seeing were multi-million dollar houses. And it's been that way ever since. And so the squirrels' nests have gotten bigger. Our culture has changed. And I think, you know, I congratulate Brooks for identifying this, there's something fundamental about that. So there's a whole bunch of issues here. Are we all responsible for each other? At what point do we yell out, hey, warning, warning, Will Robinson, the culture's melting down? And how do we discuss these topics broadly? What is the role of government in all of this? These are, I think, legitimate topics for discussion that we need to have, particularly in election year, and particularly when we're deciding who's going to be representing us. Mary in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I love your show. I love you. I listen to you all the time. And I got to tell you, you're making me crazy.
Okay.
You know, I agree with you 1,000% that it is our responsibility to take care of each other, that every great society is judged by the way they take care of the least of their people. They're sick, they're poor, they're babies, they're elderly. But that's not the way we need to sell it. You know, the problem is, this is such a me society, every man for himself mentality. And like that guy you were talking to a little bit ago who said, I don't believe everybody has the right to health care. You're not going to sell it to him that way. Hey, let's do the right thing. That doesn't work for those kind of people. And unfortunately, there's a lot of those kind of people out there.
Well, that's why I made the point, Mary, that if the government was running the program, instead of having Bill McGuire pulling his $1 billion salary out of the top, you'd have, you know, people with, you know, boring government jobs, and I don't mean that as a put-down. I think it's a marvelous thing, you know. You know, with a pension and not a lot of churn, and they know that they're there and they're doing a good job. And you'd have people doing this rather than sucking the top off it. It cost a lot less. I mean, 20% of our total healthcare budget of the United States is going to profits and dividends. It's being siphoned off the top, and CEO salaries. That's obscene. So that's, I agree with Mary. Excellent point. And that's the way to sell it. It's a very, very good point. Mary, William in Miami, Florida. Hey, William.
Hi.
Yes. Hey.
I'm calling in reference to, I mean, the amount of money that we spend on defense and everything else. It's ridiculous.
50% of our budget is defense.
Yes,
half of all your taxes.
That we can't afford insurance for everybody, and a lot of these congressmen waste a lot of money in Congress, and that there is no oversight on the money that they use on the little projects.
Yeah, well,
it's,
you know, it's
ridiculous.
Yes, there is pork and all that kind of thing, but you want real pork? Go look at the Defense Department. I mean, it's totally out of control, and these no bid contracts. I mean, the Bush administration has elevated crony capitalism to an art form. This is so wrong. Jim in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Jim.
Hi. I've never called before, but I was listening to the gentleman a few minutes ago talk about the health care problem and that it needs to be privatized and that that's a good idea. And I think the flaw in his thinking is that the playing field is level, and that's what I hear from people like that all the time, is that, well, everybody has the same right and everybody should know the same thing, and that basically if they make bad decisions, that's their problem.
Right, and if you sign a bad contract with a health insurance company, it's because you didn't read the fine print. And I'm like, oh, we all have to go to law school now? I mean,
right.
That is not a level playing field, I'm sorry.
No, it isn't. And if you look at society, people do not make wise decisions all the time. Lots of people make wise decisions, but there are people that aren't as educated as other people. There are people who perhaps can't even read the contract.
There are people who are busy.
Just let those people die?
Right. There are people who are busy. There are people who make hasty decisions. All excellent points. Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate the call. David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, David.
Yeah, hey, Tom. I just have an example. What happens if you're sitting in the back of an ambulance with a life-threatening situation? Are you supposed to call your insurance company on the way to the hospital so you can find the cheapest insurance and you can find... just an example here. I took care of an ex-veteran, and he couldn't afford his health insurance. He wasn't at the VA, so we wouldn't... It's impossible to find out how much a CT exam is going to cost or an MRI beforehand, whether or not you're going to pay for it with a 20% plan or anything.
Right, The idea of somebody having a heart attack sitting in an ambulance and dialing hospitals and saying, how much is it going to cost and how do I shop around for the, it's absolutely crazy. Healthcare, thank you, David. Well said. Healthcare, in my opinion, should be a right. It is part of our commons. Richard in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom. Listen, the overall scope of what's happening with this country, you know, when you had that guy on earlier, I'm half Native American, but I'm also half Anglo-Saxon. Mm-hmm. And you look at the evolution of this country from the time that the Anglo-Saxons came over and pretty much annihilated our race, you know, and stuck us on what they consider reservations, which are actually more like prison camps because there's no work.
Yeah.
You know, the resources are very sparse. There's people freezing to death in the winter, dying from heat stroke in the summer.
Yep.
And, you know, the American people have been duped for the last 500 years into believing that this system is there for them, when the system's really there for the system. Because without the system can't perpetuate itself.
What system are you referring to?
Well, the government. Because, you know, you take tribal cultures, and everybody in the tribal cultures takes care of each other.
Yeah.
But nowadays...
Well, that's how we should be as a nation right now. And,
sure.
In fact, I think that was the original idea. You know, and in fact, I mean, Jefferson and Franklin in particular wrote extensively, and James Madison, about how, you know, patterning the American government after the Iroquois Confederacy.
That's
you know, the idea of community. I mean, we basically ripped off the Constitution from the Iroquois.
That's right, from the wampum belt.
Yeah.
You know, but when the American people are free to choose what they are told that they can choose, then they are being duped because they're not actually free. They're being told what they have as options instead of creating their own options.
Yeah. Excellent point, Richard. Richard, I got to take a break here. Thanks so much for the call. It's you're right. We're told, do you want to win a war or lose a war in Iraq? Hey, wait a minute. The war is over. It's an occupation. Do you want to end the occupation or maintain the occupation? Somehow that question doesn't get at. For example, I mean, you know, just right across the board, all these false choices, all these weird, only two options. Come on. 45 minutes past.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
To be the one to say it was no good what we done. I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
9.5 minutes before the hour, and we got a lot dizzy stuff going on out there. Well, let's see. Lesbians of the world, you can breathe a sigh of relief. The word lesbian is still legal to use. Three residents of the island of Lesbos, the birthplace of the ancient Greek poetess Sappho, whose love poems inspired the term lesbian, brought a lawsuit last month in Greek court arguing that the word lesbian should be banned worldwide. The Athens court said that, it could... In fact, they actually went so far as to make a positive definition. The Athens court said the word did not identify the identity of the residents of the island, and so it could be validly used by gay groups in Greece and abroad. And they ordered these three cranky members of or residents of the island of Lesbos to pay court costs of $366.20. So, you know, sometimes good things come out of court cases. 866-303-2270. Tim in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Tim, listening to WDTW. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Number one, as a Greek American, I agree with the Athens court.
Okay, good.
I think so. It's
Greek town in Detroit, by the way, is just when Louise and I lived in Detroit in the early 70s, we used to just love going down there every Saturday and have, you know, it's just a great Greek community. In
still going strong, yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about this whole notion of healthcare. I've noticed that there's this sort of debate, and I think we should put it out in the open, that whether healthcare is a right or not, and I see it axiomatically as being a right,
like the right to life, like the right to liberty,
and we need to debate it in that frame. Do the
I think it's part of the right to life.
Exactly. I mean, if you don't have healthcare, by definition, you don't have life. Right. And I think we need to argue that with the American people. I don't believe we are a me society. I think that's a media frame that's been propelled since Reagan that we are a me society, but we're not. We are a we society. And we need to tell people, not tell people, but inform people that, look, healthcare is a right. And the question is, how is that right secured by the government? That's the question.
Right. Yeah. And very well said. And in fact, there's been, and thank you, Tim, for the call. There was a ballot initiative, I believe, here in Oregon a year ago, 2 years ago, and a number of people proposing this to say healthcare is a right in this state. And it got defeated, if I'm recalling this correctly, I may have not have made it onto the ballot, but in any case, it didn't pass. But that's what we need to do, is we need to say healthcare is a right, period. Now, you, states, figure out how to provide it, or federal government, figure out how to provide it. Margaret in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, Margaret.
Hello, Tom. I have had some thoughts about several threads going on this morning, and I'd like to try to tie them together a little bit. Mm-hmm. First of all, on health care, where I'd like to come out after I do this is that I think we're being shaped not only by government but by business to give up assumptions and definitions that we've always had about what house is big enough, what free is, and the reason we're being shaped this way is so that we're better profit centers, so we can help other people make money.
Right, we've been turned from citizens into consumers.
Yes, I have two examples. My first example is that I went to see an acupuncturist a couple of months ago while I was taking radiation treatments for cancer, and it was to help me reduce side effects from mm-hmm. the cancer. And I was kind of in a shaky way when I went into this office, you know. Mm-hmm. And the acupuncturist, lovely young woman, and I'd looked forward to seeing her. I was really looking forward to feeling better. She gave me a paper, and she said, sign this, and I can treat you. Well, it was a paper that giving away my rights to my judiciary system. If I sign this paper, I could get treatment, which I needed badly, and it said that I would accept mandatory arbitration if anything bad happened to me.
In other words, you gave up your right to sue.
Yeah, I had to give away my rights as a citizen of this country.
Right. There, you know, in most mortgage contracts, actually, it's been 15 years or so since I've had one or signed one, but it's the last one I signed actually had a paragraph in it that said I was giving up my rights under the Constitution.
Oh my God.
I forget which articles of the Constitution, but it says, you know, I am voluntarily surrendering these rights. Yeah, Margaret, it's well said, and thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry to hear about your illness, and I hope you get better. That's a tough one. Joan in Montana, but thank you for the call. Joan in Montana. Hey, Joan.
Hi, how are you today?
Just great. But I'll get better.
Good. I was going to relate a little story and then give my comment. Mm. When health insurance first came out, I went to my doctor's office to pay my bill, And I asked him why my bill was $2 more. And he said, well, you don't need to worry about it. You just pay what you always did, and we'll get $2 from the insurance company. So I don't think health insurance has ever been for the people, because we pay thousands of dollars. We have deductibles. We have we're restricted of where we can go. So I think health insurance is for the health companies and big business.
It is right now, yeah, and it should be for us. I mean, and I guarantee you, if the doctor is getting an extra $2 from the insurance company, that's going to come out of you and me somehow.
And I'm still paying for it because I'm paying for it anyway because I'm paying for a deductible, I'm paying my insurance premium, and I'm paying my minimum payment. So yeah. I believe that health care should be in charge of a system that eliminates all these health insurance companies.
Well, yes, and let's take all the profit out of it. Excellent. Well said, Joan. Thank you very much. We're just about out of time here. Bob in East Lansing, Michigan. We've got a half a minute, Bob.
Okay, well, a couple of points. It's already a private system, and it's not working.
That's right.
And private does mean for profit, and profit means that they insure healthy people.
Mm-hmm.
And just about the time that people get to where they're sickest and they're turning them down for their payments, the premiums they've paid in while they were healthy are now paying the lawyers. You know, here they are, they're at their weakest point financially, emotionally, physically, everything, and the premiums they've paid in are paying a bank of very intelligent lawyers who know all the ins and outs, which you and I don't, to fight you.
Yeah, and the insurance adjusters or whatever they call these people who, yeah, absolutely, Bob. And it's like, why should we be doing that? I mean, this just makes no sense to me. If we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, tell me that life and happiness don't have something to do with health. Coming up next is Sex in Crisis. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes even, as the Fireside Theater says, everything you know is wrong.
Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And things that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is everything we know wrong about the sexual revolution and conservatives and sexuality and all this guy? Is sex in crisis? Sex in crisis. The new sexual revolution and the future of American politics. Dagmar Herzog is with us in the studio here in Portland, Oregon. She's tonight at 7:30 going to be at Powell's Bookstore for all our listeners in Portland. Dagmar, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm pleased to have you with us. Your book, the two main arcs of your book that I found most interesting were, number one, that conservatives have essentially redefined sex. Religious conservatives have redefined sex away from religion and into a secular context by getting hyper-hysterical about STDs, and mm-hmm. AIDS certainly was a gift to them in that
mm-hmm.
regard,
mm-hmm.
and redefined our dialogue about sex. Mm-hmm. And second, the whole discussion of how sexuality is treated in continental Europe, as opposed to
right.
England, but, you know, in continental Europe. So first, let's start with the reframing, the redefining of sexuality in the United States.
Well, it's a big story, but basically I used to be a historian of Germany. I studied Jewish-Christian relations, Nazism, and the Holocaust, and I studied how the Nazis associated Jews with dirty sex while promising their own followers clean and spectacular sex, and I never expected to be studying the United States. But I was shocked to find the sexual culture changing so rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 2.5 years ago, I started from the puzzle of how it had happened that liberals had gotten so defensive and were unable to defend sexual rights and were totally tongue-tied. How had the religious right managed to take over the terms of conversation, and yet nobody was screaming, nobody was noticing it?
Right.
And, of course, as you've just indicated, one of the answers I came up with through my research is that, paradoxically, the religious right succeeded by secularizing, by pretending not to be bringing God either into the public schools or into the public sphere, but by making arguments for sexual conservatism in the name not only of physical health, by wildly exaggerating the dangers of disease while casting aspersions on condoms, but also by taking over the terrain of mental health.
Right.
The very fuzzy category of self-esteem became unbelievably important. But a huge technique was to say that sleeping around is a sign of low self-esteem. Prostitutes have low self-esteem. Abortions will cause low self-esteem. Homosexuals have low self-esteem. And it's very hard to argue against, and liberals have become tongue-tied. But the puzzle for me was...
Is there, you know, I think gays have been an oppressed minority. That can be pretty hard. I can imagine... only vaguely, you know, being a man, but that having an abortion must be at least an emotionally dense decision, you know, process.
Right.
That being a prostitute could be a pretty tough job.
Mm-hmm.
And being promiscuous, I know in our culture promiscuity is elevated, is applauded for men and not for women. So wouldn't all those cases actually be true that?
Well, I think your kind of response shows why people are so easily befuddled and confused and don't start from the premise that sexual rights are human rights and that everybody has the right to sexual self-determination and people are different and that's to be cherished and defended.
So in European cultures, for example, these self-esteem issues are not issues.
No, completely not. The European Court of Human Rights starts from the premise, and they went through a long post-fascist learning process to get to this point, right? But they figured it out, that everybody has the right... they see the task of the law not only to defend people against sexual violence and humiliation and harm and abuse, but also to protect every individual's rights to consensual sexual self-determination. Mm. And that starts at the age of 16.
Yeah,
confidential health care is a rudimentary concept.
Right. You point out in the book that, number one, in the United States, about 50% of all the information that's given to our kids in our schools about sexuality and sex is wrong.
Even in the new comprehensive sex education program, it's pathetic and awful. I mean, sex education in this country is in tatters right now.
Yeah,
lying to people.
And number two, I thought it was fascinating. You pointed out that when Switzerland decriminalized prostitution, when Germany decriminalized prostitution, people yawned.
Right.
There was no public discussion. You know, there was no debate. I mean, it was just like, yeah, of course, let's allow prostitutes to have the protection of police and access to the health service, and let's, by the way, collect taxes.
Right. They're having a little trouble with the collection of taxes. It remains secret in a lot of ways, and it's an undercover thing, and crime does tend to circulate around prostitution, so they're not entirely happy with the results, but they do start from the assumption that people have the right to sell their bodies if that's what they want to do. And, of course, we have an immense amount of prostitution in the United States as well. It's just that we cause more trouble by criminalizing it. I guess the point that I was really interested in is how did the religious right manage to do the sex work for the Republican Party, right?
Right.
The Republicans came to power via sex, let's be honest, and it's interesting that...
You mean recently? Are you talking about the impeachment of Bill Clinton?
In the 1990s, the religious right managed to take over state legislators and, in general, the national politics as well, casually in hundreds of localities around the nation by playing on fear and loathing towards homosexuals. So they began by targeting a sexual minority. Mm-hmm. That worked unbelievably well all through the 90s. They treated homosexuality as perverse, disgusting, and fearful, and or as sort of homosexuals were pathetic heterosexual wannabes. That worked really, really well, and no one could have guessed at that point that they would go after the heterosexual majority. That's only happened since the turn of the millennium, since President Bush has been in office, and that was this interesting puzzle for me. What made Americans so insecure that they would allow the religious right to take over the
country? Right, and this is where the religious right's message essentially is that the only kind of sex that is actually valid, shall we say, that's legitimate, is sex between a married man and a woman who are married to each other.
Correct. We're living through a major assault on all non-marital sex,
right,
even though 95% of Americans have had premarital sex, and most of them know it's make their marriages happier.
Yeah.
But people are unable to say that. So the puzzle for me was, why did Democrats get so intimidated? Why are they so insecure? What was it that made people so insecure about postmarital sex that they were no longer able to defend premarital sex? And I came up with some insights into that, and it has a lot to do, counterintuitively, with the discovery of Viagra in 1998 and with the rise of internet porn. Those were the two bizarre, counterintuitive phenomena that threw heterosexuals for a loop. Why is that? Because Viagra helped millions of couples. It helped millions of men. It's a wonderful drug in a lot of ways. However, it had this unexpected after effect of causing confusion about what's turning the man on. Is it the drug or is it his partner?
Uh-huh.
The ability to perform is not the same thing as the feeling of desire.
Right?
And it raised that insidious problem.
And Viagra, I have to confess, I've never used it. I don't know if it increases sexual desire or does it, because it's certainly the ads seem to imply that.
What it does is allow their ability to perform.
Period. It's purely mechanical. Different.
It's purely mechanical. Now, a lot of sex is mechanical, but a lot of sex is also emotional.
Right, sure. Ideally.
Ideally. Well, no. I think people are really complicated, and desires are really complicated. And what's really interesting is that as the pharmaceutical companies have desperately desired expansion of their market niche into the female half of the human race, they've tried to find this pink Viagra as well. This has not worked. Partially, it's because blood flow to the genital region is not the same as lubrication. Partially, it's because women seem complicated. They actually do seem to care about emotions. But also, it's because it's just hallucinatory to create this new disease category, which now does exist. The FDA has approved this creation of this thing called female sexual dysfunction. And what's happened in this whole discussion about this, with the ever-helpful health reporters and women's magazine industry endorsing the notion that there is such a thing.
Which used to be called frigidity.
It did, and that's now considered much too limited a conceptualization, because what you want to do is create hysteria and dissatisfaction about one's sex life. In the 90s, Americans, the last serious study that was done, Americans were totally satisfied with their peanut butter and jelly marital sex lives. Once a week, perfectly happy and contented, no problem. Generous towards others, not a big deal. And what's happened since then is now studies, you know, show unbelievable rates of dissatisfaction. And nobody knows if that's real or whether that's just a fomented, manipulated production of misinformation. But the effect is...
Or is it that a new ideal has been established by TV ads for Viagra and whatever the other...
Or what they're doing for women now. They tried apomorphine, which is a drug that works on the brain but also increases blood flow to the genitals. That didn't work for women. They've tried to offer testosterone, which supposedly at least creates the yearning for sex, the desire, if not the arousal. But the whole thing is complicated, and it's not working so well. So all they've managed to do is raise expectations of perfectibility. But the other big thing is internet porn. Okay, internet porn has caused enormous confusion about whether it's the images swirling in people's heads or the body in bed with them. So again, it's an insecurity about the relationship between sex and love, and that created an opening for the religious right.
And the religious right has stepped through this opening and taken control. Are Americans taking sex back from the religious right?
Not yet. I'd like to see that.
They've won the battle so far.
We're living through a war on condoms. We're living through a war on female sexual independence, a war on the moral concept of consent. And so far, everyone's much too scared to say anything.
That's absolutely incredible. Dagmar Herzog, am I pronouncing it right?
Yes.
Yeah, Dagmar Herzog. Her book is Sex in Crisis, The New Sexual Revolution and the Future of American Politics. And is there a website, by the way, for this?
You can go to my homepage at the City University of New York.
Okay. And we'll put a link. It's a rather long one, so we'll put a link to that at tomhartmann.com. Dagmar, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks so much.
And for our listeners here on KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, she'll be at Powell's tonight at 7:30. It is 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann radio program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. And boy, oh boy, oh boy, strange stuff going on out there, I'm telling you. This guy, Dan Glass, maybe he's crazy. I don't know. He's with a climate change group called Plain, P-L-A-N-E, Stupid. And he goes to shake Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, shake his hand, and his hand is covered with super glue. And he says, you're not going to shake me off. Excuse me. He says, we cannot shake away climate change just like you cannot shake away my arm. Well, he smuggled the pouches of glue into the event in his underwear, which raises a whole nother level of what could have happened there. When he left, he tried to glue himself to the gates of Downing Street, but the police detached his hand from the gates of Downing Street, just like they detached him from Gordon Brown's arm. So, anyhow, strange stuff. Strange stuff. It brings to mind pies in the face and other things. I think there's a place for theater in politics. I really do. I'm just not sure I'd want to super glue myself to anybody in the Bush administration. Just the idea of it is too creepy. Joe Klein. last night on Anderson Cooper 360 raised an issue about John McCain's comment that Barack Obama would rather lose a war, would choose to lose a war in order to win an election. And I think Joe Klein's statement, Joe is the regular columnist for Time Magazine, who, you know, is kind of an in-the-middle kind of guy. Sometimes he's portrayed as a lefty, but, you know, a lot of lefties have a lot of problems with Joe. But in any case, I think he was so spot on with this that it's worth replaying. This is Joe Klein last night talking to Anderson Cooper about John McCain's comment.
What is far more serious is the way that McCain continues to characterize this war in these stark terms. A year ago, he was saying that if we left, Al-Qaeda would take over the entire country. Al-Qaeda is a tiny Sunni sliver in a big Shiite country. That was never going to happen. McCain has been overstating his case throughout. In part for effect, I suppose the question is, does he really believe this? But what he said today, and David Gergen is absolutely right about this, what he said about Barack Obama being willing to lose a war to win an election is the most scurrilous thing that I've heard a presidential candidate say in the 9 elections I've covered. Scurrilous things have been said before, but they're usually said by aides and the fact, or by spokespeople. And the fact that John McCain would choose to do this by himself is a very significant moment.
A very significant moment. I agree. I absolutely agree. And I think that we had the guy on, the vice president of the Media Research Center, the right wing media watchdog they call themselves group, on the program. Was it yesterday? I believe, Sean. Thank you. And. I think that this, and they were saying, oh, the media is in love with Barack Obama, and he gets so much more media coverage. Of course, not pointing out that when they aggregate all the media coverage, it includes all the fact that, number one, Barack Obama was fighting a battle with Hillary Clinton for the nomination for much longer than John McCain was in the race. Number two, that Reverend Wright dominated so many news cycles. I mean, a lot of the coverage of Barack Obama has not been what you would call positive coverage, but nonetheless, I believe that what the right is doing right now and what the John McCain campaign is doing right now in running ads suggesting that the media is in love with Barack Obama is twofold and is very calculated. Number one, they're trying to say to the American people, don't pay any attention to that coverage. Don't listen to what the media says about Barack Obama. It's been tainted. They love him, you know. So it's not objective what they're saying. So don't listen when the media tells you that the prime minister and the vice president of Iraq agree with Barack Obama about pulling U.S. forces out of that country. Don't listen when the media tells you that Hamid Karzai liked Barack Obama and, you know, thought he's somebody he could work with and was very appreciative that Barack Obama wanted to redirect our attention toward Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Don't listen when Barack Obama talks about, you know, fill in the blank. Number one. And number two, the second part of this campaign, this media campaign, is to cause the media themselves to become self-conscious of their coverage of Obama so that they will begin to become critical of Obama because they have this weird notion. The media in this country has this weird notion that everything has to be balanced. We're all trying to be fair and balanced. And so, gee, if we're being told that we like Barack Obama too much, we better pick on him some just to prove that we're balanced. This is called playing the refs. Lee Atwater identified this and was the master of this thing. He's the guy who coined the phrase, I believe, or he's at least the one who popularized it, the phrase playing the refs. Let's get the media on our side. Let's work the media. And John McCain has been playing the refs for over 20 years in public life. He is so good at manipulating the media. And now that his shtick isn't quite working, now that people are seeing through his lies, and yes, they are lies, for example, his statement that the escalation that he calls a surge caused the Anbar awakening, the tribal sheikhs to say, give us some money, we'll stop shooting at you. No, I'm sorry, the order was reversed. John McCain's lies. Now that the press is not buying his story, hook, line, and sinker, he's getting a little more crotchety. and they're trying to say, oh, don't pay attention to that Barack Obama guy over there.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Cost is, you know, getting it ain't hard. You sign along the dotted line, you can take it home today. Buddy, let me tell you, you're gonna pay and pay and pay. Oh, MasterCard, you mastered me. I'll still be paying when I'm 83. Some things I bought are broke or gone. Oh, MasterCard, where'd I go wrong? Oh, MasterCard.
34 minutes past the hour.
I'll still be paying.
Dennis Kucinich, by the way, his article of impeachment against George W. Bush will be heard before the House Judiciary Committee on Friday. And you can help out. Let your member of Congress know that you are supportive of this, that you are supportive of the 35 articles of impeachment, House Resolution 1258, the three articles of impeachment, House Resolution 333 and 799, or this current one, House Resolution 1345. There's a great, a couple of actually great posts over at Democrats.com, Bob Furtick's website, Democrats.com, that where you can just click right through to email your representatives to support Kucinich's articles of impeachment. You can, you know, contact your neighbors, call talk shows, whatever, you know, get the word out. We had Dennis Kucinich on the show last week talking about this. Get the word out that this should be taken seriously. This must be taken seriously. If we don't hold our elected officials to the rule of law, particularly the president, and I realize I am sounding like the Republicans who impeached Bill Clinton, but there was some truth to what they said about the rule of law. Tragically, they were applying it to something that was largely irrelevant to the American people. Nobody in America, outside of Bill Clinton's personal family, I would argue, was directly affected or impacted by his, whatever you want to call it, with Monica Lewinsky. His having a good time with Monica Lewinsky, or, you know, however. You know, obviously it impacted his family, but it didn't impact you and me. On the other hand, Bush, listening in on our phone conversations or listening in on the phone conversations of our Democratic lawmakers and using that information against them in political strategy does affect us. The Bush administration listening, reading our emails, invading our homes, strip searching us at airports electronically, on and on and on it goes. I mean, tearing apart the Constitution, that does affect us. The Bush administration leading us, lying us into a war in a country that did not represent any threat to us at all, that does affect us. It affects all of us. We all have to pay for it. I suppose you could argue that we all paid Bill Clinton's salary during the, you know, the few hours that he was having a good time with Monica Lewinsky on a couple of different occasions. But, you know, again, I'd say, you know, that it's irrelevant. But a war is real. It's relevant. 866-303-2270, Devron in Seattle. Hey, Devron.
Hey, Tom. My hat's off to your last guest and the battle that she's raging out there, and I think it's tremendous. I hope you can have her on more often.
I agree. Dagmar is great, and her book is great.
I want to focus on McCain, but right quick, I've been out here supporting Obama, saying, you know, I voted for him because he's black. I flip-flopped on that, all these different reasons. You know, when he's becomes president and inaugurated, then we can go after Obama and these issues. The man studied the Constitution, so I'm praying and knowing that he's going to bring it back for us. But yeah. McCain, at the last top of the hour, this is why I called Tom. it's about victory. The victory is about honor, coming home with victory and honor now. That's why our soldiers are dying in America. Right. Pay attention to that. This is crucial. This man is just, this is crazy.
Yeah, John McCain has redefined our mission in Iraq.
Please.
Yeah.
Right now, it's about we got to come home with victory and honor. That was when Bush was landing the jet plane on the aircraft carrier.
Yeah, this is that phony patriotism that Richard Nixon tried to use as well. Well, you know, of beating your chest and you know, yes, I triumphant in the empire.
Yeah.
We're the, you know, yeah, it's
yeah, and be scared of us. And
yeah.
You know, the same thing. Why we're you know, beating up on Cuba, this small island, you know, it's all about big, strong America. And we've got some issues here, but we can get it straightened out. Thanks, Tom. One love.
Yeah. Thanks, Devron. Appreciate the call. And well said. Janet in Plantation, Florida. Hey, Janet.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
I think you, part of a dynamite team with Joe Connison and Mike Papantonio, should be on national TV, the three of you together.
Well, thank you. Joe and Mike are great.
I know, and so are you. My question is, I heard last evening, I don't know if it's true, but can you comment on it if you know, there was a 10 p.m. meeting of the House of Representatives recently, and it was behind closed doors, supposedly about declaring martial law in the face of economic collapse in this country. The only person that had the backbone to stand up was Dennis Kucinich, questioning why is this a secret meeting behind closed doors?
Right, although to the best of my knowledge, he didn't get an answer. And,
no, of course he didn't.
And as far as I know, yes, there was a secret meeting. And let me just add, the Republicans frequently have secret meetings, although they don't typically interrupt the proceedings of the House to do it. And whether or not this was about martial law is something that, as far as I know, and I've seen, you know, I've gotten the 500 emails over the last week about this, you know, or the last couple of days about this, and seen the websites and the, you know, I don't want to call it gossip because I don't want to diminish it, but the political speculation sites, shall we say.
The problem is
that we have this lack of information, and the Republicans, I mean, it's like the mafia. They're very good. They're omerta, you know, they've got their vow of silence and they enforce it. So I frankly don't know, Janet, but, you know, hopefully we'll find out. Ron in California. Hey, Ron.
Hi, a couple things quick. With Korea recently, the administration, you know, they had direct talk and they had positive results. And with Iran, they're having some direct talks. And to the chagrin of Cheney, the five-time deferment guy there, he can't go into final throws. And anyways, I want to say the surge stuff they're talking about, I think, is mostly malarkey. They paid off the Sunnis. And,
And this was before we started the escalation. This was before we started the escalation. The Sunnis actually came to us initially, the sheikhs.
Yeah.
They came to us and they said, we will engage in a ceasefire against you, and we will kick out these crazies who are coming into our country, these other Sunni crazies who are coming into our country representing the so-called Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
We'll kick them out of the territory if you'll just start paying us $100 per month per man, and we will create an army for you. We'll call it the Awakening Army. And
yep.
We've been handing them those dollars, and it's a whole lot cheaper, frankly, than paying to have tanks and troops and contractors and everybody else in there. And so, you know, we're paying, you know, a couple
yep.
million bucks a day to pay
Tom,
for the Awakening, but it's shut down
yep.
the violence.
Tom, one other point. Yeah. We don't ever forget that in 2005, Negroponte went over there after the Fallujah uprising, and he declared that what Iraq needs is Salvador option, which means black ops, death squads, bombings, and most of that, it's been proven, the Brits were caught pants down, dressed up as Arabs with all the garb and bombs,
yep.
and we've been caught in an article in globalresearch.ca, we've been nailed at checkpoints. Sometimes they load up Iraqis' cars with explosives, send them on their way, and so forth, or if they arrest a guy for some...
Ron, if you've listened to the show for a long time, you'll recall that when Negroponte was sent to Iraq, on this show, I pointed out that when Negroponte went down to El Salvador and was our ambassador there, within a week of his arriving, you had death squads, or 2 weeks of his arriving, you had death squads, and you had people showing up with their hands tied behind their back and bullets in their heads. And at that point, that was not happening in Iraq. 2 weeks after Negroponte showed up, that started happening in Iraq, just as I predicted on this radio program. You can go back and listen to the archives. Mark in Minneapolis. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. I want to piggyback on a couple of things, including something that Senator Sanders had to say last Friday. about FISA, and he made a comment that I've never heard any public official yet state, nor the ACLU, that 70% of the intelligence gathering domestically is undertaken by private contractors.
Yeah, that is pretty shocking, isn't it?
Now, everybody's talking about this immunity provision, you know, seemingly exclusive to the protecting the telecoms. Well, if 70% of the intelligence is being undertaken by private contractors, does that mean all of those 70% contractors also receive immunity?
Well, and then there's another question. If, for example, Lockheed Martin is one of those contractors.
Absolutely.
Let's just say, for example, I believe they are, but
they are.
I don't know. Okay. Are they using this, or could they use this, to listen in on the telephone conversations over at Boeing, who's competing with Lockheed Martin for defense contracts?
Or hedge funds.
Yeah, right, who might be manipulating their stock, or that could this be used? Could this intelligence information be used for domestic business purposes as in addition to what I've been saying all along? I'll bet you anything the other thing that they're doing is they're wiretapping Democrats, and they've been doing that from the get-go, because this wiretapping program did not start on 9/11 like the corporate media keeps saying. It started 3 weeks after George Bush was appointed president by the Supreme Court, after he was sworn in.
This is personal for me, because in 2002, during a lawsuit from one of these very, you know, close government contractor employers of mine, mm-hmm. I was threatened that they had the capacity to tap my phones and read my ISP. And I have every reason to believe that happened.
Wow. Mark, thanks a lot for the information. And excellent point to put on it. I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour, and as always, got to take a break at that point. We'll be right back here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Stick around. 866-303-2270. Actually, I think Ellen Ratner is going to be with us when we come back. We'll see.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
DJ, 17 years old, 1968, WITL, AM&FM, Lansing, Michigan, playing country music. As a teenage rock and roll fan, I thought I was going to go crazy. I came to appreciate it eventually. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line. And Ellen, I got a couple of stories I'd like to run by you before you run yours by me. May I? Number one, I thought you would love this. I to let all our listeners know, by the way, we have a new cat in our house, a kitten actually. My brother and his partner took it. Tammy took it in because it was so violent toward people. This little kitten, this 13-week kitten, apparently a semi-feral kitten, that they couldn't get it adopted out. And so he and Tammy were trying to socialize it. And whenever we get near it, it jumps up and attacks us and bites us.
Oh.
And so we've been running a contest for the best name for it. And so far, Louise's favorite is Fang, but we're going to make a decision tomorrow. But anyhow, here's the story. A porcupine wandered into the eastbound lanes. I know you love animals. That's why I'm giving you the animal updates here. A porcupine wandered onto the eastbound lanes of Interstate 90 in Spokane, Washington, found itself trapped between the lanes. And Washington State Patrol, stopped. What can we do? Trooper Mark Barker went out and with a transportation department worker and a shovel. and they were able to pick up the porcupine and cross the highway and let him free. So isn't that, that's kind of good news.
Oh, I love that.
Porcupine story. Okay, that's the one. And then the hard news, your brother was involved in these three lawsuits about Guantanamo against the Bush administration that were all where he won them. You know, where they, do we have rights of habeas corpus and these
exactly.
kind of things? And the ACLU on their homepage at ACLU.org right now has a headline that says Congress should demand answers from Attorney General. And another, tell Congress don't subvert the Constitution. And apparently the Bush administration and Mukasey are asking for a new, they're asking Congress for a new declaration of war, an actual official declaration of war, which will legalize everything Bush has done up to this point and will legalize the concept of enemy combatant and will allow, will basically declare the entire planet as a battlefield and the United States is the primary combatant and have the, you know, we give us the ability to take anybody we want under any circumstances anywhere. And, well, I'm reading from the ACLU's website. Mukasey is asking Congress to expand and extend the war on terror forever. Anyone whom this president or the next one declares to be an enemy combatant could be held indefinitely without a trial, and the Attorney General's proposal would hide the torture and abuse conducted since 9/11. And so people, I'm asking people to go over to ACLU.org and click through on that and stop that. I'm wondering if anybody in Washington, D.C. is talking about this kind of stuff.
Well, I haven't heard anything, but I will tell you this, that as you know, Charles Schumer supported Mukasey. And, in fact, he said, well, he was the best person, and there was an, one of his underlings was also up for the job and apparently lives next door to a pretty lefty attorney. And I'm blanking on the name, but, you know, Charles Schumer, when I actually asked him about it, said, Mukasey's the best guy, there isn't anybody else, Well, there was somebody else, and he was already in the department. But now Charles Schumer said, when asked about it, that he's very disappointed in Mukasey. This is after testimony.
Yeah. I think Mukasey should be impeached, frankly.
Well, I think Mukasey should be impeached as well, and it's really very sad. But now his supposed supporter in the Senate, Senator Schumer, is very much against him.
Yeah, well, impeachment proceedings would have to start in the House, and I would love to see some member of the House
Representatives. Well, it looks like impeachment proceedings, well, not in terms of Mukasey, but as you know, it was referred to, impeachment was referred to the Judiciary Committee, and it looks as if the hearing will be held on July 25th.
Right on Friday.
So that is definitely going to be happening.
Yep, and people can go to Democrats.com, and there's a great link there where you can send an email to your member of Congress. You can contact them, call them, and say, or you go to callcongress.org. We've got the toll-free numbers for Congress there, and you can call your member of Congress, your member of the House of Representatives, and say, please support the Judiciary Committee, and please support Dennis Kucinich in actually having a hearing and actually finding, asking the hard questions and demanding answers.
Today is the 60th anniversary of the integration of the U.S. Armed Forces, and Nancy Pelosi spoke about it, and Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. It is also, just 45 minutes ago, began the hearing, or 50 minutes ago, of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the House. Shalene Espinoza was supposed to be a witness, but her airlines in the Mideast would not let her come back, not because of this, but because of training issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so she submitted written testimony to the hearing today.
Good on her.
That is going today, and that will actually be in the record, her testimony.
Oh, that's great.
And if there's another hearing, she's going to come back for it.
Great. Congratulations to Shalene.
It's interesting that originally I couldn't understand why they were choosing today, but just like, you know, gay marriage was on the anniversary in Massachusetts of the Brown versus Board of Education. It's interesting that the hearing today is taking place on the anniversary of the integration of the armed services.
Hmm. Yeah, it is.
You know, they never say the connections, but they're clearly there. Also, the president rescinded his veto threat against the housing bill. The housing bill.
Yeah, now that they've added to that housing bill a provision that allows them to fingerprint anybody who gets a mortgage.
Well, that's correct. We are seeing our rights go down the tube very
right
quickly.
Out the window, yeah.
And they also approved electronic medical records today.
Oh, my. Okay. Another incredible. Ellen Ratner at TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, real estate developer and property rights expert Don Koras, author of a new book, Government Pirates. Should be interesting. Christy Harvey's going to drop by. Best of the rest of the news and, of course, your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. Call Congress. Tell them to support Kucinich and help the ACLU, ACLU.org. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.